Okay, don't forget as we go along, if you want to say something, you'll have to unmute your mic and just go ahead and break in, and we'll give you an opportunity to say. First of all, I just want to go through and do a quick review of what we've studied so far. We won't spend too much time doing that, and then we'll get into the question and answer period. Yes.
We don't see your PowerPoint.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
I'm still working on that. It's coming.
Okay. I'll go ahead and just, we'll do a review here real quick, and then we'll have the PowerPoint. So in the opening chapter of Ezekiel, we find him in the midst of the exiles in Babylon on the river Chebar when he sees a vision coming from the Lord from the north. And in the past, we studied various books of the Old Testament. We find that's usually the direction that trouble comes from. We talked about the vision that he saw at some length, but it tells Ezekiel that God is not bound in any one place, such as Jerusalem, but he's everywhere. He's all-powerful, all-seeing. He's all awesome in his might and his splendor, and Ezekiel could not really describe what he saw, so he uses terms like "it was like," and he tries to describe it as best he can. Ezekiel is sent to warn a rebellious people. Jeremiah 3:25 says they have always sinned. And we'll see this repeated as we study chapter 20 of Ezekiel. In 2 Kings 17th chapter and in the book of Ezra, we're told it was a reason for their exile. Then Ezekiel is bound with rope, struck dumb, and he's only able to speak when God puts words in his mouth. Ezekiel's goal, and God's goal, that is speaking through Ezekiel, was to warn people, not to make them listen. We're told that in Ezekiel 2:4-5, and we see a parallel to this in the New Testament in Matthew 10 and in Acts 13 chapter. Next, Ezekiel is told to take a tile and draw an outline of Jerusalem on it and draw in siege ramps and battering rams and siege engines against it. And he was told to lie down on his right side 390 days, signifying the time that Israel sinned. We can remember back when Jeroboam was ruling the 10 northern tribes, and out of fear that some of the people would travel to Jerusalem, he set up calves, one in the north and one in the south. And we find that in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 20-33 describes that. Then Ezekiel is told to lay on his left side for 40 days, and that signifies and represented the 40 years that Judah sinned against God. We find that Israel's sins exceeded that of the countries around them, and as a publicly punished. Jeremiah tells us in chapter 19 that because of their defilement of the temple, they would be forced into things like cannibalism. Remember when he cut his hair, shaved his head, and he took three parts of his hair, a third of the nations, signified that a third of the nation would die of the plague and famine. Now the third would die by the sword, and a third would be taken and scattered amongst the nations. The nation of Israel would become a horror to the nations around and would serve as a warning to others. the destruction that was would be so complete that the land would become desolate, and they received their just due. We are warned of the same thing happening in Romans 2, verses 5 through 10, and James 2:13. Then we find that Ezekiel, as he's talking with some of the elders, and his home is caught up in the spirit, and he's brought to the temple in Jerusalem, temple in Jerusalem, where he sees all the abominations being done, even inside the temple. Women worshiping the god or goddess Tammuz, sun worshipers at the east gate of the temple bowing down to the rising sun, images of animals and insects drawn on the temple walls being worshipped. And this was done by the priests as well. Then Ezekiel sees a repeat of the vision he first described in chapter 1, and he watches as God instructs one of these individuals that he sees to go throughout the city and mark those who have mourned the terrible state that Judah was in. And these people were the ones who survived when everyone else was destroyed. God points out then that the sins of the people were too great to show mercy and they would receive what they deserved. They thought that God would not notice their sins. We're told today in Hebrews 10:26-31 that we should never forget. Then Ezekiel sees the presence of God depart from the temple and go east to the Mount of Olives. And we see that in Zechariah 14:4. Ezekiel's spirit is then returned to Babylon, and he tells the elders gathered in his home what he has seen. So that kind of is a quick review of what we've studied so far. Now in chapter 12, he's told to act out a play. And this is our first question in our class tonight. In Ezekiel 12, he's told to act out a play. Describe this play and its purpose. Who would like to attempt to tell us about this play and describe it for us? Be sure and unmute.
He was set as a sign to Israel to act it out. And he packed a bag and he walked among the people so they would know that they were going to exile. And he dug a hole in the wall and he went through it to show them they were going to exile.
Okay, who is he talking about?
The remnant.
Okay, anybody else?
They're rebellious leaders and citizens who were spiritually blind and deaf.
Okay, in 2 Kings, the 25th chapter, we have a description of what actually happened. You remember that Ezekiel is told to put on clothes. He's supposed to pack his bags. Like he's going into exile, he's supposed to dig a hole through the wall, and he's supposed to cover his face so that no one will see him, and he's trying to sneak out. And what he's doing is playing what went on and that we read about in 2 Kings 25th chapter, and that is that Zedekiah and his followers, some of his advisors, some of his family, some of his warriors, part of his army, they're going to dig a hole in the wall after dark there in Jerusalem. Zedekiah is going to cover his face and he's going to flee through that hole. And but the Chaldeans see what's going on, and they chase him, and they catch up to him on the plains of Jericho, and they capture him. God says that he would cast a net over Zedekiah and his army. And this is what the Chaldeans did. They caught him up. They got Zedekiah. They got his family. They got some of the advisors. They scattered his army, took him, a lot of them prisoner, and so forth. And so they were brought. What happened to Zedekiah? Anybody remember?
He was blinded.
Yes, that's right. And they took Zedekiah and the prisoners that he that were caught with him, and they took him to a town, a place called Riblah, which is actually was in Syria, between Babylon and Israel, and Nebuchadnezzar had set up his camp there. And I have no doubt that Nebuchadnezzar was absolutely furious at what went on here, because he's expending his assets in order to make these, to besiege Jerusalem. He's done this for a year and a half now. He had to break off for a while and go deal with Egypt. But Zedekiah, and before him it was Jehoiachin. Before him it was Jehoiakim. And so here is Zedekiah, who had pledged loyalty to when Nebuchadnezzar had appointed him. His original name was Mattathiah. He was related to Josiah, grandson, I believe. And anyway, he had pledged loyalty when he was appointed, and then he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar and went and asked the Egyptians for help. So here's Nebuchadnezzar one more time. He's besieging Jerusalem, and I'm sure that he is absolutely livid having to do this, and he's going to decide, all right, I've had enough of this stuff, and I'm not going to have this happen again. And so he's working God's purpose. He's just going to absolutely destroy Jerusalem, and he's going to kill most everybody. But he takes Zedekiah and his army does, and they bring him to Nebuchadnezzar in Riblah. And Nebuchadnezzar passes judgment on him, brings his sons before him, have his people slaughter his sons before his eyes, and then they put his eyes out. And they throw handcuffs on him and haul him off to Babylon. So this is a play that Ezekiel is supposed to play out, showing what's going to be happening in Jerusalem. How did, I really answered the question, how did Ezekiel respond to that? And in chapter 12, verse 7, he said he did what he was told. He acted this out, so that people would, and this basically was a prophecy. This is exactly what happened, and I think it was a sign that he was a true prophet. I think they're going to see that later. Number three, what was God's purpose in sparing some of the people when Jerusalem fell?
the remaining people were to declare all their abominations to the Gentiles wherever they go.
Okay. And verse 16 in chapter tells us, so that they would tell of their downfall and their it would let the nations where they go to know about the Lord. This was very few people that was left over. In fact, later on, we'll see that Nebuchadnezzar's commander would go back into Jerusalem and grab a bunch of priests and some of the men of the 60 men of the city, I think. Also, some of the king advisors that were left there, some of the commanders of the army. And he would take those back up to Riblah as well. And Nebuchadnezzar would slaughter them. So there wasn't very many people that was left. What was Ezekiel's response when everyone said his prophecies were of events in the far future? And they did this also to Jeremiah. Remember in Jeremiah, when we studied Jeremiah, that happened to Jeremiah as well. That's going to happen. If it happens at all, it's going to be way, way in the future. So now what's God telling Ezekiel when everyone said his prophecies were going to be a long time in the far future?
Soon to pass.
Okay, and Daniel, it said it came to pass. It was done. I think that's in Daniel 9, if I remember right. But God said it's going to happen in your generation. It's going to happen now. I'm not going to put it off. I've had it. There's not going to be any delays anymore. And so God brings this about. Number five, where did the false prophets get the message that they were preaching?
From their own visions and inspirations. It was all their own doing.
That's right. They talked themselves into that. They, I guess we all do this to some degree. Anyway, they just conjured up this stuff in their mind. And that's what they were, the message. And of course, it was just exactly the opposite of what Ezekiel and Jeremiah were telling. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to have peace. If this happens at all, it's going to happen way out in the future generations. We're not going to have to worry about it. And so they were inspired by their own thinking, and they, God is all, it tells what he's going to do with these people. Number six, what promise did God give about people who tried to seek him without giving up their idols?
The sinner's sin would be his punishment.
Okay. Dean, can you advance the PowerPoint? Okay, great. Okay. Okay. Somebody read chapter 14, verse 7 and 8.
Or any one of the house of Israel, or of the strangers who dwell in Israel, who separates himself from me and sets up his idols in his heart and puts before him what causes him to stumble into iniquity, then comes to a prophet to inquire of him concerning me. I, the Lord, will answer him by myself. I will set my face against that man and make him a sign and a proverb, and I will cut him off from the midst of my people. Then you shall know that I am the Lord.
What does he mean when he says cut him off from among the people?
Spiritual death, maybe?
I think that probably means that plus physical death. I think God brings about their demise. Okay, what great servants are used for faithfulness in chapter 14?
Noah, Daniel, and Job.
Okay. And what is God saying here in chapter 14 about these three people?
Their faithfulness could only deliver themselves.
That's right. It says even their families would not be saved. Their sons and daughters, they themselves would survive, but they were the only ones. Everybody else, including their family, would be destroyed. So that tells you just how bad. You remember the story of Abraham, and the angels visited him and said that they were on their way to Sodom and Gomorrah, that the sinfulness had come up before God and God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And they said, if you can find 50, you find 40, find 30, got down to finding 10. God said, no, I won't destroy it if you find 10 people. And they couldn't do that. So Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. And we're going to find that the sins of the people of Israel were actually compared to the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah and were 10 times worse. The sins of Sodom and Gomorrah were half of what Jerusalem and Israel had done. So that gives us an idea of just exactly how bad this was. So when the exiled Jews finally saw the survivors from Jerusalem, what would they know about the justice of God's punishment of that city? Was it justified?
It was not without reason.
Okay. In chapter 14, verse 22-23, it says it was justified. In chapter 15, we have a story of a vine. And who can explain that story of the vine? Anybody want to take a shot at it?
If the vine does not produce any fruit, it is no longer good for anything else and should be destroyed.
Okay. It says if wood is taken from it, can you make anything? Can you make a peg out of it to hang something from the wall? About the only thing good it's for is to burn in the fire. In other words, it's basically just a waste. And he's referring to Jerusalem here as an absolute waste, good for nothing except to be destroyed. So that tells us God spends, there's about 8 or 9 verses of there going on explaining the value of a vine and comparing it with Jerusalem. And I think it's pretty clear there what he was trying to say. In chapter 16, God is speaking of whom?
The Jerusalem.
Okay, he's speaking of, actually speaking of Israel as a whole, but he has concentrated on Jerusalem, and he's basically saying, you know, your mother was an Amorite, your mother was a Hittite, your father was an Amorite. You're like a baby that was born and not cleaned up, wallowed around in your own blood. Talks about God's grace, what all he did, brought them, he cared for them, he took them as his own. And it gives a fairly lengthy description of how God took these people and made them his people and nurtured them. Punished them when they needed to be punished, but they were a special people to him, and he gives them a lesson, a history lesson, and basically it's a God's grace, showing God's grace to an ungrateful and unfaithful Jerusalem and a nation. So and compares the sins of Jerusalem with the sins of other countries around them. And they were worse than any other countries around them, any countries who had ever been. They had just reached the bottom of the barrel. And God's grace is just going to end. And they're going to be punished. Anyway, that is all I had for this lesson. Does anybody have any comments or want to talk about something or in specific?
It takes me a minute to get it. Okay. I do.
Okay. You want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay. You're on.
Ron?
Yes.
In chapter 14 and the last part of verse 4, he says, every person from the house of Israel who brings up his idols into his heart and places before himself a stumbling block of his guilt, and yet he comes to the prophet. I, Yahweh, I will respond to him through this act with respect to the multitude of his idols. Then in the 16th chapter, and verse 59, I willed it to you, or I will do it to you according to what you have done. So he essentially, since they wanted to be harlots with all the other countries, they always wanted to be like them. Therefore, they adopted those idols for themselves. Now then, he's going to take those countries and bring them in and destroy them. Because that's what they wanted. They wanted to be just like them. So they're getting the multitude of their sins. He just took that and gave it to them.
It's if you'll remember Moses way back during the time of the Exodus, he constantly reminded them, asked them to get rid of their idols. They brought stuff from Egypt. all during the time of Moses, all the time during Joshua, through the time of the judges. We have a constant reminder of God extorting these people to turn away from the idols that they had carried. It goes back. Who was it? I can't remember. It was Jacob's wife, I think. It was Laban's daughter that stole her father's idols and covered them up on her saddle, brought them with her. So we see this. These people in Ezekiel are told, you're coming before the Lord, you're here in my home, and you're asking me to inquire of the Lord, and yet he knows your heart. You're not admitting that you have, you're worshiping idols in your heart. That's what you're looking at. And God sees that. They're trying to hide it. But that's what they think in their heart. They just can't wait to get out and bow down to that piece of rock or piece of wood or whatever like that that they've, can you imagine what these people have done in the temple in Jerusalem? All these people are going to go by the wayside. God's going to take care of them, physically. They're not going to survive, but, can you imagine just profaning God's temple like that? They had history. It was written history. It was vocal history. They had all these things. They knew what God had done for them in the past. And yet they departed from the worship of God and went to idols. And like you say, Faye, that's exactly what they wanted, to be like other countries. You remember it was a theocracy, and they kept telling Samuel, was it Samuel?
Yes.
Yes, Samuel. They kept telling Samuel, well, we want a king like other countries. And so Samuel anointed Saul after God instructed him to do that. So they rebelled back in those days. They saw the other countries around them, had a centralized government. Samuel warned them, hey, they're going to do this and they're going to do that to you. They're going to take your sons. They're going to tax you. They're going to take your properties. They're going to take your money. They're going to take your sons and turn them into soldiers and so forth and so forth. But they didn't care. They wanted a king so they could be just like all the other countries surrounding them. So in spite of all these blessings that they had time and time again, the Lord brought them back, judges to get them out of their pestilence and famines and that type of thing that they were going through because of their sinfulness. And yet, they just fell right back into the same thing over and over and over again. These people knew their history, and yet they still worshiped idols. I think I've mentioned it before. I have a sister-in-law who's a Buddhist, and her husband, my brother, one of my brothers said, he said, I don't understand it. I really don't. But he said, I've just finally given up on trying to argue with her or talk about it to her. And she goes in there and does her ooh-ah-oohs in front of a candle or incense and front of that piece of rock that's carved out like a chubby fat guy. And, you know, I mean, these people have known this all along, and yet they're willing to do this. And it's got so bad God is showing Ezekiel in the temple just how bad it is, what they've done. And I've given up on these people. This is what's going to happen to them. I'm sending my appointed one around in the city of Jerusalem to mark on the forehead those people who have bemoaned the sad state that Jerusalem is in. These are faithful people, and they're the ones that are going to be surviving this disaster when finally Nebuchadnezzar's army goes in and they utterly destroy Jerusalem. They cut down everything that's in, they tear down the temple, set it on fire, take all the valuables that were left over, cut up and take them off to Babylon. They went back in and they burned all the rich people's houses, just made it in utter desolation. And so this is where we find the people of Israel. They're destroyed. So we'll study some more about this next week. I hope that you will study chapter 17, 18, 19, and 20 for next week, and we'll talk about that and see what. And I'll try to get the information out to you a little bit earlier than I have this one. Anybody have any comments?
Ron?
Yes.
It seems to me that one of the things that he's alluding to is the fact that the men played the harlot by marrying women who weren't of Israel. And their children were an abomination, and one of the reasons why everybody was being raised with idolatry. So, I mean, they just kept bringing it in and bringing it in.
Well, you know, I always think back to Solomon, who was the most brilliant man ever. Nobody came close to him, and yet in his... He had, 700 wives and concubines. A great deal of those were marriages for political purposes, to align Israel with other countries. But he allowed these wives to bring in their foreign gods and idols. And... he set up places of worship for them. I would like to think that Solomon repented of his wrongs, but we're not told that. So, he just allowed a weakness to creep in. And so this is what happened. Of course, the Jews marrying somebody outside their bloodline, foreign people and stuff, it turned out to be Samaritans, I think, that were they are referring to. Okay, anybody else have anything to say?
I do, Ron. I think about us today. We're supposed to be God's temple, the indwelling of the Spirit. And destruction will come on us too, you know, just like back then with them. Destruction in, you know, whatever way. But the thing is that it's comparable. I mean, just a different time, but still, we are supposed to be his temple now.
Yes, that is correct. Jesus talked in Matthew about that. Also, Paul, of course, going through talking about the various countries that he had visited and people that he had set up in congregations and so forth. He's giving the same warning to these people, you know, giving them ample warning to, you know, people had crept in to the congregations and had can't remember what the word I want to use there, but anyway, they had crept in and brought falsehoods in and took and twisted God's word and caused all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. Paul comes in and says, I can't believe it. You know, you're so soon that you have departed from the truth. I can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we're warned many times in the New Testament that we're going to have to watch out for this.
Yep.
So Ron, yes, go ahead.
Ron, it's Linda. I have a friend who follows Buddha. You follow Buddha or I don't know. And I remind her or tell her of idols, that you are not supposed to worship idols. And she says, oh, no, Buddha doesn't want us to worship him. He is not the God. He is not. He is just a person with words. She says Buddha wants the followers to think of his words and honor his words and practice his words and what he preaches or says. And by looking and lighting a candle to his figure, you're thinking of his words. So what do I say to somebody like that? She says, no, Buddha is not God.
Well, it's they've replaced God with the image of Buddha. They're not following God's word. They're following Buddha's word. If you compare what Buddha says with what God says, I think you're going to probably find a substantial difference in the two.
Yeah, I have suggested that. And, you know, they just turn a deaf ear. I'm amazed.
Yeah.
I'm amazed.
They've rejected God. You know, just it's the same as in Islam. You know, they don't. You know, they go to the prophet and worship him, even though he says, "Well, I'm just a prophet. I'm not God." Mm-hmm. They believe in God,
mm-hmm.
but they don't worship God. They worship
the image before them.
Sure.
Oh boy. Thanks, Ron.
It's very difficult. And you're right. It is difficult to talk to them.
I know, because the sayings of Buddha comparable. But you know it's not God's word, but they're so convinced and they convey it like, yeah, it's hard to talk to them. It's too bad because they're nice people.
You know, they are. And
they mean well.
I'm sure they're sincere.
Yeah.
But you know, I have some friends of mine who, you know, are charismatic people and of course, when you start getting into the charismatic movement and you start getting into speaking in tongues and whatnot like that, and you know, it's very difficult to talk to people. We, Sharon and I have some family members. Her niece and her husband were faithful members of the church. They had a bad experience with their daughter being in the hospital. She was very, very seriously ill. Church members came in and you know, were a little negative in their comments and that type of thing. And some charismatic people came in and said, well, let's get together and we'll pray for your daughter. And they did. Well, she got better. And they became convinced that that charismatic movement was what they needed to be part of. And they, they rejected the church and, you know, they're part of the charismatic movement now, and they believe in speaking in tongues and, you know, we've talked to them a little bit about it and, you know, they just kind of shrug it off and, well, and they know better. They've spent all their younger years in life, and half their adult life, as well, studying God's word. And yet they still, went off on this charismatic thing and they've just gone way out in space and, nothing you can say to them that's going to change their mind. At least that's how we feel. But, and it's too bad, you know, but you find, and, you know, and they're sincere, I'm sure they are, but they work just as hard with this group of people that they're with as they did when they were members of the church, and they were hard-working Christians, but they just got sideways over that, and, you know, we have to be really cautious about what we say to people. You know, we can plant a good seed, but we can injure people by what we say as well. Anybody else? Okay, don't forget chapter 17 through 20 for next week. And if you come up with some questions that about this week's study, let us know, and we'll try to cover that when we go back review a little bit next week. We'll just review chapters 12 through 16 next week real briefly. We'll start all over. I think we've covered that enough. So anyway, that's all I have. Professor is going to sign out.
I'll see everybody that wants to be in a part of the canon class tomorrow night, 7:30. I think I have finally made sense out of my outline. I'm kind of at the point where it's not as good as I want it to be, but I'm going to have to send it out anyway. So you'll get an invitation, and the outline that we'll use tomorrow night, just shortly.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron.
Oh, thank you for being here. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
All the support.
Good night.
Thanks for the questions and all that good stuff. Okay, guys. Hope you have a great night. Take care. God bless everyone.